Welcome to Editing Aloud. I have with me, as always, a panel of South Africa's best and most well-informed journalists. A week ago, the Rand was crashing. Now it seems to be picking up again. Lukhando Mnyanda, to what do we owe this kind of happy turnabout in the Rand? Have we done anything right, by any chance?
Maybe I should start by being negative, by saying it's still like about 20 cents weaker than it was before Ace Magashule's intervention last week. So that was to keep that in mind. But it's been a good few days since then. I mean, I think we sort of moved to calm the storm, like with the statements from the governor and the finance minister and also the president eventually. And I think with some good news on Friday about Mexico, you know, Trump was going to impose tariffs on Mexico, which is also going to be bad for emerging markets and, you know, the whole emerging market trade story. And since then, also, obviously, we've had the Fed being very dovish. And I think people like the bets on the Fed that are dropping U.S. rates in July are quite big, actually. Bigger than ours, the chances for our rates going down. So all that international picture is looking quite positive for the Rand at the moment. And obviously, we had some nice data yesterday in the manufacturing Fed numbers, which also there must be a disclaimer because we had such a terrible first quarter because of the load shedding and everything else. So now you're going to see all these numbers suddenly picking up because they're coming from such a low base, so which makes it highly unlikely that we'll have another recession.
What is your call on whether we have a recession in the first half or not? Because last week we were definitely predicting one. This week, not.
Yeah. As things stand, I mean, the economy, things have been so bad. I mean, it doesn't look like there's any other way but up. As Lukhanyo has just mentioned, that some data that just came up, they show that, you know, things are improving, things are looking better.
Rob, the ace factor. So last week, eventually, the president comes out and says, no, we're not changing the mandate. Though I'm not very clear if he did in fact say that. Has that been enough to clip ACE's wings, to allay fears about the independence of the central bank and its mandate?
I don't think it's been enough to allay fears completely. I mean, I certainly think that it's good that the finance minister, that the ANC's head of economic policy, you know, Gondwana, also said this, and that Ramaphosa has given an indication that they're not going to do that. But I think the concern for investors is you have the ANC's top body, the NEC, coming out with a statement that you would imagine would have been authored by somebody and agreed to by this group, saying that actually we are going to do this. So does this indicate that the, you know, the president is not in control of the process within the party, and hence even no matter what they say, this thing could still happen? It makes very clear the fissures in the party, and I think that's the concern more than whether this would actually happen. I mean, obviously it's nonsensical, this
quantity easing.
Oh, I thought it was quality easing. Maybe it was just Batavile Dlamini.
Quality easing would even be better.
Yeah, so I suppose quantity easing is what they should do at the bar before they release statements like that.
Well, the weekend newspapers did indicate that the Secretary General may have inserted some stuff in the party's statement, after it was agreed. But as you say, I mean, what does that mean for the president's ability to effect reforms?
Yeah,
well, I mean, if the party is constantly at war with itself.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the real concern, is that you have a what would appear from the weekend reports, like you say, is almost a rogue Secretary General who has a very instrumental hand in certainly how policy is conveyed to the public, never mind how it's created. And so this illustrates that getting anything done is going to be extremely difficult, certainly in terms of reform. And it illustrates just the extent to which ACE is a real block towards that. But on a positive side, if he had done that, if he had inserted those, if he has essentially gone rogue, and there are other allegations against him too about changing the ANC's party list for parliament, if any of those lead to any action within the ANC, certainly would give the president cause to take action, then that could be a good thing. You could isolate Ace Magashule now, who's proving to be even more destructive than I think many expected.
Alistair, do you have any sense that this guy's getting his wings clipped?
I think so, but my sort of gut feel is that Tito and Cyril are on the same page. I think Cyril already trusts Tito, and he's got a lot of experience, you know, Tito in Treasury and now as Minister of Finance.
So, and cooking.
And cooking. And cooking. And even on Twitter. I think behind the scenes they have the right sort of policies in place. It's just maybe Ramaphosa doesn't want to do anything too public against ACE yet, and then cause more issues. So he's got to have a plan to kind of, I don't guess, rein him in. But, you know, markets react very quickly now.
And it feels very uncertain. I mean, we've got, it's even if we knew, T said, so that the mandate was not going to be changed. I mean, what does that feel like in relation to markets? I mean, because it's like constant, you never quite know where you are. I mean, how bad is that for investment or growth?
Yeah, look, it's
or
a sentiment game in the capital markets. I mean, the guys, yes, they do look at facts, but, you know, if you've got a high-ranking official like that coming out with reckless statement like that, you are likely to get a reaction, and that reaction is not good. I mean, we've seen how the Rand reacted. Even though, you know, you had some really powerful guys like Tito coming out to put out the fire that caused by, but, you know, as Lucas has mentioned, it still, you know, hasn't, the Rand has still hasn't fully recovered from that level. So it's really a sentiment game.
And we've got the State of the Nation address coming next week. It's the second of the year, but the first of the president as a sort of his own administration, if you like.
Yeah.
What would you want to see in it, or what would you hope to see in it that might reassure that the government was actually going to do something about growth?
Personally, I would like him to admit that the current economic formula is not working. It needs to be changed. There needs to be a fundamental change in how we do things, because we've been stuck on this for the past 25 years and not much has changed. In fact, we are now the most unequal society in the world.
Lucanya, what are you looking for? What would you want to see in the State of the Nation address?
No, it's a good thing we started with Iran. I mean, we were talking before, like, about how when, you know, the period leading to the election, we actually had the best currency in the world. And since then, despite this recovery, we've had the worst. You know, we're like down at something like 4% since like May 10. I think that's the worst performing, like, sort of emerging market currency. So it's got a lot to do in terms of boosting that confidence. I mean, the problem, like, with this, like, Sonas, and he always says the right things in all of them. I mean, if you look at the last two that he did, because he had one when he first arrived, had another one this February. And then I don't think you'd find anything there that you disagree with. It's just a question of actually getting this stuff done. And some of it is really quite simple. I mean, we look at the whole thing about visa regulations. I mean, why do we need to keep talking about that? I mean, it's just do it, right?
It's a bunch of instructions to Home Affairs officials. Rob, you wanted to...
Telecommunications.
That's the issue, like you say. It's not about how we speak. That's fine. We say all the right things. It's about what we do. We do nothing about jobs. We do nothing about reassuring people about the, you know, actually showing that we're doing the right things. So talking is fine. Changing the visa rules, we haven't done that.
Yeah.
So do stuff.
To change the rules. Don't we just have to implement the change rules? Well, the visas is one area. What are some of the other areas where you want to just see quite a strong signal that something was actually being done or going to be done?
Well, policy confusion. I mean, employment is the biggest thing. So clarity around that. I mean, the relationship with the unions is very difficult for Ramaphosa because that's where he drew his base from. So I suppose it's very difficult navigating around that. But certainly with regard to mining, with regard to education, with regard to the public sector, you need to have a really firm sense that you are cutting back on the public sector spending. That's what the ratings agencies want. And we had the story today in Business Day about the finance minister putting in place certain caps
on municipalities,
saying you can't, for example, travel business class. You know, you've got to travel, you know, cars that are over 700,000 rand. You can't do that. You can only replace a car once it's driven 120,000 kilometers. Those are kind of standard things that you'd expect in government to be happening, and it's a good thing that is happening. So things like that.
Municipalities, is this the end of the gravy train?
No, I doubt that, because, I mean, there's local government, there's national government, there's so many different parts, and, you know, people have been set in their ways, I think. You know, they kind of expect certain benefits. I think it's going to take time for, you know, them to kind of get a new kind of culture, I guess, of spending. You know, it's new spending habits for politicians that they have to learn. But I think we're quite impatient, maybe because we've just been through such a rough sort of decade, you know, under the Zuma government. So we're probably quite hard on Ramaphosa. I mean, you know, that election was about a month ago. He's got a new cabinet. I think that the cabinet actually needs to now get a chance to sort of bring in what they want to bring in, you know, or implement policy. I mean, you can't implement it in a month. So yeah, I don't know, it might take 6 months, you know, just personally, I think, before we really start to see changes. And maybe in, you know, I think what soon will be next year, February, then we'll actually start, you know, be able to judge the sort of new administration.
We've had, I don't know if, I mean, we've had protests about SAA. I think last week we spoke about the SAA chief executive, Lucanio, departing, and the Eskom chief executive departing. Now we're getting pushback from at least one of the unions about those departures. What does that tell us about prospects for restructuring those particular public entities?
I mean, it's really interesting, you know, like a headline that says, like, we want our CEO back, says unions. It's not something you see every day, is it? So, yeah. So I'm still a bit confused about what the actual issue is.
And he has a little CP, we want our education MEC back.
Indeed, yes. Is there a trend here?
There are a lot of positions, high positions, that are filled with people who are not competent. So when you find somebody who is competent, you are desperately sad to see them go. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm. I mean, what's surprising is at SAA, it's a company that should retrench some stuff. So, and if you've got the union saying, well, we want him back, and then, but he hasn't really talked about, you know, retrenchments. So that could probably be the reason. In their dialogue consultations, that look, we will try to limit the amount of job losses at the airline. But you know, we all know that the airline is bloated; it has to get rid of some.
That's a good point. Because of the SABC, for example, a lot of people like Claudio Motsoeneng because he raised their salaries and didn't retrench anyone.
Yeah.
But that's bad for the institution. It's not good for the sustainability of the institution.
Correct.
So I think you have to look at those calls with some degree of skepticism.
Yeah.
Yeah, one's concern would be that they might want Mr. Jahanabek because he didn't do anything, rather than because he did. And it sort of puts question marks about the whole public sector, going back to, you know, is to what extent, now the way is clear, we supposedly have a smaller number of ministers. I mean, are we going to get more efficient government? Alistair, any chance?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it says it's a smaller government, but it doesn't feel that way. And I think you could have merged so many more, you know, departments, but it's such a tricky job, you know, that they've got to do in that regard. So there has to be some cut in spending, but you know, you're sitting with, I suppose, parastatals that are in so much trouble, and that's really where the money's going to be going. That I think that's priority one. I mean, what else can the government think of than, you know, Eskom and SAA at the moment? I mean, we saw this. Yeah. There's this whole case now, you know, around environmental issues around Eskom, and I noticed on Twitter some people are complaining that Business Day was leading about, you know, how much more money, how much more debt this could create. But that really is, you know, that's what cripples the economy, is if, you know, Eskom gets into, you know, even more trouble, or SAA, and then it takes all our money and our debt just skyrockets. So that's the most pressing issue. It's that and a lack of jobs. Everything else just kind of looks like a nice to have, but it's, you know, maybe it's only next year or in 2 years' time.
Rob Rose, the front cover of your Financial Mail this week. Tongaat, is the Steinhoff 2.0? Number one, is the Steinhoff 2.0? And number two, what do you feel about the shares being suspended on the JSE?
Well, the first part of the question, it's not quite Steinhoff. I mean, it's far more simple. It's not as complicated. And the question of whether there was actual intention is the real issue. Steinhoff, there was an intentional move to create fictitious transactions, 106 billion rand of fictitious transactions. In this case, there was a valuation of land. Land sales were recognized before they should have been, and the valuation of sugar cane in the ground was inflated. Now the question is, was that done intentionally, or was this a mistake? Was this reckless? I mean, the question of culpability is a big thing. And secondly, the impact of Tongaat, a much smaller company than Steinhoff, which was one of the top 40, which owned a whole lot of brands in Europe. I think, you know, in a sense, the size is very different. In terms of the suspension of shares, that happened yesterday at the company's request. And a lot of people are very angry about this, because if you have a company that's undergoing something like this, a sort of an accounting crisis, you want to be able, the market wants to be able to buy and sell the shares and say, well, we don't want to be stuck in this position for 4 months while they get the audited financials out. So a lot of investors are very angry about the JSE treating them almost like as if this is a nanny state.
Did the JSE have the right to suspend on Tonga's request, in fact?
I found it very surprising myself that the JSE would allow that to happen because...
And they didn't do it with Steinhoff, right?
So why would they... You know, because you would want to get out as information tickles in. Mm-hmm. You would want to get in or get out. But now you're stuck in a company that's clearly, something suspicious has happened. So you would want information to tickle in. Sentiment, as I said, is a sentiment game. So
has anyone asked the JSE? I mean, how does the JSE justify this?
I just thought they stopped it because they didn't want the share price to fall any further.
That's in the company's interest, but is that in the investors' interest?
It sometimes seems like it's not too clear what the JSE can do and can't do. I guess what they can do as an exchange is stop shares when they want to because it's their exchange. That kind of makes sense. But we've seen lots of corporate scandals where they've just sort of sat there. And I mean, there are many companies that are like cash shells that are still sitting on the exchange. They haven't been suspended. But clearly there are issues. Why were they listed ever?
In the sector you cover, there have been companies which have run into trouble and not been suspended.
There's a company called Freedom Property Fund, which is still listed. Mm. And you never hear anything about it, and it's been on there for years. Mm. And I think that's dropped to like a cent or something. But if you ask them about it, they'll say, well, we're an exchange. They pay us fees. Mm. We can't judge if they're good or bad, but... Yeah, so then they're following the rules. You only suspend them if they break our listing rules. So I don't know if has Tonga broken the listing rules.
Has Tonga broken the listing rules?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, besides obviously deceiving investors, which probably isn't great for governance. But in this sense, one of the problems with suspending it is that it creates firstly, it's a bad signal to international investors that if something happens, you get stuck in the share. Yeah. And secondly, it'll create potential panic selling when next you have an accounting scandal. The investors will think, well, let's just flood this thing, sell it, panic, sell all our shares, because what you could potentially have is you're stuck in this thing if the JSE decides to suspend it. So it sets a bad precedent that could panic people in future.
So, Lucanya, would that mean that the minute there's bad news in future, people will race for the exits so they don't get stuck?
Rob says, you get stuck. And also, I think the messaging from the JSE is a bit confusing. I think in other cases where they've been criticized, whether it was Sagamatha or wherever, they've said that, we're just a marketplace. It's not our job to actually regulate companies in that sense. We want to make sure people have got all the information so investors can make decisions themselves whether to buy or sell. Yeah. But I don't know how this then fits in with that philosophy. It seems to be in contradiction. I mean, you mentioned the Steinhoff thing. I think the point has been made that the reason Steinhoff was not suspended, it wasn't because of JSE, it's because Frankfurt refused to suspend it. So it would be interesting. I think we need to get a bit more messaging from them.
What Tongaat said is that there's two levels of information coming out. There's sort of information trickling out into the market, and there's information we're putting out, and there's this disparity in information, and that is a ridiculous excuse.
Everybody has that.
But then it's up to Tongaat put out the correct information, to say, this is the level of information, this is what we understand. Yeah, the company can't blame everyone else for the fact that it's not communicating properly.
One of the issues that has arisen, of course, is the issue of auditors, in this case Deloitte's. Once again, auditors are a little bit in the spotlight. And in fact, one of our BRICS neighbours, India, is threatening to suspend some of the big four. I mean, Rob, does this cast aspersions again on the whole profession?
Well, certainly Deloitte, the auditors of Steinhoff, they're the auditors in this case, and they've been auditors of various other companies. I think they're the auditor might be potentially of Resilient as well, a couple of other companies. So, the 2018 financials were signed off by Deloitte for Tongaat, and those are the financials which Tongaat now says you can't rely on those things. So if an auditor is there to provide assurance that this is what's actually true and it isn't true, then a lot of investors will ask, what's the point of auditors? At Steinhoff, I think Deloitte earned 266 million rand in the last year for auditing. And if you end up with a result you can't rely on, then why are you spending this money? So I think it creates big questions over the auditors. I mean, having said that, are you...
Do you say so? I mean, we've had quite a run with the auditors.
Yeah, we did. I mean, there has also been an impact. I mean, there was a report by the WEF, I just can't remember it. Basically, we've dropped quite significantly from where we were in terms of standards. I think we were number one in terms of accounting standards. Now we've dropped to about 37 or something.
But it seems to be a kind of global issue. I'm starting to wonder, do people now become like training accountants and go and do their articles and whatever and then try and kind of rush through that to get into corporate finance? They can go, you know, become cowboys of industry, and they don't actually think about what their role is as an auditor. That you're actually some kind of watchdog. You aren't in it, you know, to kind of make money. I wonder if auditing firms now have this sort of profit motive, and they're not, and they've lost
You mean the idea of auditing as somehow accountable to the public?
Yeah, you know, that you actually have a role to bring out the most accurate, free, fair, correct kind of financial information, and check companies aren't doing things. But your whole, it seems like the mindset is that a lot of young people, you know, become CAs, and then they sort of work as an auditor, and they're like, okay, now I want to go into corporate finance and work in banks and things. So their brain's not even in it. I don't know. That just seems to be the perception. I don't know what the average age of an auditor is now, but I'm pretty sure it's probably quite like young people. You know, people don't stick.
And I wonder how much audit rotation actually helps or hinders.
I suppose you could argue it's like a structural problem where your job is to hold somebody accountable, but that person is also your client. So there's an inherent conflict of interest there.
Right.
So I don't know how you get around that.
Sarnoff case, this was an ingenious thing. It was the guy, Marcus Joosten and his pals, had basically found a way to basically fictionalize the cash flow. Now, the cash flow is the one thing you shouldn't be able to fictionalize. So these are ingenious things. I mean, an auditor who comes in, who looks at a company, it's very difficult for him to go through a complicated fraud like this. It's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've been looking at TymeBank, the new kid on the block in banking.
Yes.
Are we now looking forward to a more competitive banking sector? How do the new entrants stack up, particularly TAM?
Competition has definitely started. I mean, things have heating up. I mean, you've seen responses from some of the major banks launching, free bank account monthly bank accounts, just basically to stay in the competition, because some of these guys are nimbler and they don't have the costs that are associated with running a branch. So they're coming up with really shaking things up. So with TymeBank, the most interesting thing that has happened today, this week basically, is that they are going into unsecured lending.
What we used to call microloans.
That's right. I mean, that is, I mean, for investors, that's a clear path to profitability. So that's what you want to see. You don't want to just see a bank that's popular with customers because it's offering free services. You also want a bank that's growing and growing profitably. And they're going into this lucrative market, but also very risky.
I was going to say, Alistair, is this a clear path to profitability or is this a path to potential?
Yeah, I was driving the other day and there was an advert for a bank that's been in that space for quite a long time, and they had a big scandal, and now they're kind of back, and they were talking about giving people 13.5% return or something on their money.
On a savings account?
Yeah, and then how this is the best return you can get. And I'm just thinking that's very, it's a bit dodgy and it's kind of irresponsible, because we keep saying that, South Africans don't save.
Yes.
We spend all the time. So I don't know how that's helping the kind of culture of savings and healthy financial culture in South Africa. So TymeBank could just be another, personally, I think it could be another one of these.
But isn't that a good thing if they're offering you big money on your savings? So that's that wouldn't that encourage people to save?
Well, hopefully.
As long as it doesn't get them into trouble. That would have
probably come
with the regulator, which is Kubeni Naidu at the Reserve Bank, the prudential regulator, surely would be quite careful about new banks taking risks.
I think Finance did mention that, I think, last year already, about how the new banks were going to threaten profitability in the sector, and also like there was a danger there in terms of, like you said, financial stability, that's going to be looked at very closely. I mean, they were saying that last year already, before all of this happened.
And do you get the sense from them that they're watching carefully?
I would think so, especially like in the reserve time, because they came under some flak last year with the whole VBS scandal. So I can imagine that I can't imagine that they're sitting on their laurels there, like, very comfortable and not worrying about this. But obviously, they haven't come out and said But that's a lot too cynical here. Nobody has done anything wrong. We're just saying that this is a part of the sector of the, that can be profitable, but that can also be quite risky for obvious reasons. You know, like if somebody like defaults, you don't have a house to repossess us or whatever.
But it is the first time in many years that we've had all these new entrants, Rob. We've got Term, we've got Discovery Bank, the Post Bank will one of these days get a license. There are a couple of other
Bank Zero.
Bank Zero, yes. Mm-hmm. What impact will it have on the market?
Well, it's a great thing for the market. It's going to bring down fees. We've seen Standard Bank and Nedbank launch zero fee accounts. And I think it's great. I mean, we've talked about, in about 2008, the Competition Commission did an analysis of the banks, an inquiry into the banking fees. And they said the banks, the big four, had essentially operated like a complex monopoly. And then Capitec came along and got 10 million clients by offering lower fees, by basically just being better and more nimble. So I think it's a great thing. It'll shake up the market. It's fantastic. And I think that, you know, case of African Bank, I mean, sure, you have banks that might take more risks than the big four, but I think for the regulator, for Hubert Naidoo, you can allow the new banks to take slightly more risks than you would Standard Bank because it's not as systemic at this stage.
Alistair, you very quickly, because we're running out of time now, you've been in Romania. Now, why have you been in Romania?
So
in the last minute we have.
So, you know, while the government's, you know, talking about trying to get people to invest in South Africa, a lot of South Africans have been shifting their money into Eastern Europe because that is now the next sort of frontier.
Vampire futures.
Of Europe. And so after Poland, Romania is the next biggest country. It's 20 million people population. A lot of them speak English. While educated, unemployment's about 4%. So it's become, you know, this low-hanging fruit because after communism, they haven't had proper shopping centers. So Mass Real Estate sent me there last week to look at all these shopping centers that they've spent about, you know, 15-odd billion rand on developing or investing in or buying.
Well, it's not like we don't have too many shopping centers already. So I think we're going to hope that there's going to be at least something in the statement, the nation address, that gives us some hope for an economic turnaround. And that's all we have time for. Please join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud.